This is John Quinn, and this is Law Disrupted. And today, we have the privilege of speaking with Camille Vasquez, who has received a lot of recognition for her courtroom work recently in the trial between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. In that case, Camille represented Johnny Depp. Camille, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, John. Such a pleasure to be here.
Let's start talking a little bit about your background. I gather your mother, I've read, was Cuban and your father is Colombian?
That's right.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Buena Park, California, so North Orange County. And I had an interesting childhood. I was raised, we always had our family home in Buena Park, but my father worked for Hilton Hotels his entire career. So we actually lived at the Anaheim Hilton and Towers as two little girls growing up in a hotel, which was really interesting. My father often jokes that he's grateful we got out of there before we both turned 21.
Well, that must have been a really interesting experience. And you graduated from high school in Buena Park?
I graduated from high school from a school that's no longer in existence. It's in Anaheim. It was an all-girls Catholic school, Cornelia Connolly.
Where did you go to college?
I went to USC, the University of Southern California.
It used to be known as University of Spoiled Children, I think. But
I've never heard that.
You don't hear that so much anymore. And they've been actually a longtime client of our firm's as well. And it's obviously a fantastic university, which has really come up in the world and the university rankings nationally. And what did you study there?
Studied political science and communications with an emphasis in pre-law, which indicates that I was always going to be a lawyer.
Is that true? I mean, had you always had it in the back of your mind that you wanted to be a lawyer?
Yeah, I often joke that my parents said to my sister and to me that we had two choices for professions, doctor, lawyer, pick one. It's a little bit of a joke, but it's also, there's some truth there. My sister became a doctor. She's a pediatrician here in Los Angeles, and I'm the lawyer. I wasn't particularly great at math and science, but the languages and writing, reading comprehension always appealed to me, as did any opportunity to do trial work on a mock trial level. And so it just seemed like a great fit.
Did you have lawyers in the background in your family?
No, we did not. We have no lawyers. I am the first lawyer in my family. My sister is the first doctor in the family.
So were you one of these kids that in high school you did debate, you did Model UN and things like that?
We did. I didn't do those two particular programs, but I did mock trial and I was quite successful at it. In my senior year, I had done mock trial the last 3 years of high school. And in my senior year, we had advanced to the semifinals and ultimately were kicked out as a team. We were at the award ceremony and my parents were invited, which I thought was strange because I didn't realize that any other parents had been invited. And at the end of the award ceremony, I was given the Outstanding Orator Award, which was the one student chosen amongst all the students that competed because of my trial advocacy skills throughout the competition. And hence, that explains why my parents had been invited by the school and the organization.
That's fantastic. That must have been a really proud moment, both for them and for you. Okay, so you go to USC, you study pre-law and political science. Mm-hmm. And did you take any time off before you went to law school or did you go right to law school?
I took a bit of time off. I took a year off in between and I worked. I worked at a law firm, friend of my father's, was a partner there, and I worked in the mailroom, uh-huh. And I worked shadowing the attorney.
A lot of great careers have started in mailrooms.
That's very true, especially in the entertainment industry, right? And I really started to learn what it was like to be a real lawyer. Obviously, yeah. I had seen what lawyers act like on TV, but it's very different to work in a law firm and observe what a lawyer's day-to-day life is really like. And from there, I went to Southwestern for law school and here again in Los Angeles.
All right. So you learned something about really what it was like to be a lawyer. That didn't discourage you at all. You went to law school, graduated in 3 years. And what was your first legal job?
I worked for an insurance defense firm in Orange County. and I lived at home with my parents. I worked for Louis Brisbois. And oh,
very well known, highly regarded insurance defense firm. I know one of the founders of that firm, actually.
Do you?
Went to law school with me.
Okay. Yeah, it was a fantastic place to learn. And you know, it's the type of firm that throws you in, right?
I took my first deposition. You probably saw the insides of a lot of courtrooms, I guess.
I did, actually. And I got to do some real trial work, right? I did my first trial in the first 3 years of practice, which is unique. And I was the second chair. And then I did my first deposition in my first year. And I probably learned some good skills, and I probably picked up some not so great skills, but it was the type of place that threw you in, and it was, you know, sink or swim. Thankfully, I think I swam, but I'm so grateful for the opportunities that they afforded me.
Sounds like you learned a lot there. And you were at that firm for how long?
I was there for about 4 years.
And then what did you do?
4.5 years. And then I went on to Manat, which is where I really started honing in on my skills as an employment defense lawyer. I was interested in doing employment advice and counsel and broadening my horizons doing that. Because for a while there, I thought I would go in-house. And not be a trial lawyer. I liked trial work, but I thought to have more of a work-life balance, it would behoove me to work in-house. So I thought, being a litigator, what was the best route into an in-house position? And that was by learning employment law, because most companies hire employment lawyers in-house. Mm-hmm.
Trial practice is not great for work-life balance. I can testify to that. But it's hard to do. Most companies, that even those that have significant size legal departments in-house, they don't really have litigators. It's really hard to staff for the peaks and of demand when you have lawyers who need to litigate and be in courtrooms and do what you need to do as a trial lawyer. But so that was something you were considering, but I take it you didn't do that. You never went in-house.
I never did. I really loved trial work. And again, at Manat, I had some other opportunities to do more hearings. And I just really enjoyed being in the courtroom. And so I realized that, yes, it was going to probably take a toll on my personal life and social life, but that's okay, because I really enjoyed the collaboration of preparing for hearings, preparing for trials, and working on trial teams. So I decided that that's what I would do. And an opportunity presented itself after being at Manat for a number of years to go and with a partner to Brown Rudnick, which is my current firm. And I took the opportunity.
So let's talk now about how you first got to represent Johnny Depp. How did that come about?
So I had just started at Brown Rudnick when I was approached by some senior partners to work on a new case that was going to trial in 3 months' time. They needed a senior associate to run the massive document production, search, and lead a team of staff attorneys that they had brought in to kind of go through this mountain of evidence and prepare the trial team for trial. And I was tapped to be that associate. The case was being run out of the California office, even though the partner that had brought in the client was in DC.
But by the way, this doesn't sound like a job that would bring you a lot of glory, being in charge of a staff of lawyers that have responsibility for this, reviewing this huge volume of documents. Doesn't really sound like the kind of thing that you went into law to do, but anyway.
No, but I've always been a naturally born leader. So the opportunity to find that key evidence and you know, help put together a strategy that hopefully would be a winning strategy really appealed to me. And I was given a lot of autonomy to do that at Brown straight away. So I embarked on that project. And after some time, the partners were heading to Los Angeles to meet the client, and they invited me to come along, and I did. And I remember, as I was driving up to Los Angeles from Irvine, thinking, my goodness, you're going to meet Johnny Depp. I mean, it hadn't really dawned on me until that afternoon that I was going to meet arguably one of the most famous Hollywood stars in the world. And I remember meeting him, and what struck me about him was he was so normal and almost shy. He has this really...
In my experience, a lot of actors, even stars, are shy in person.
Yeah, he has obviously this ability to turn on the charm and be incredibly funny and charismatic. But I think at his core, he's quite a shy individual, soft-spoken, incredibly thoughtful, and intelligent. That it really struck me how intelligent he was. And I remember leaving his house and saying goodbye to him. And I think the reason that we hit it off so well from the get-go was I wasn't a fan, right? I had really, I mean, to this day, I haven't really seen many of his films or his projects. I mean, obviously knew who he was, but I wasn't a super fan by any means, right? I appreciated his work and his art, but I wasn't a fan that was obsessed with him or the films he had done.
I'm sure that helped you develop a relationship of trust and confidence with him, because he doesn't need fans. I mean, in a lawyer, he needs somebody who can be an objective, trusted advisor.
And exactly.
And clearly that's the kind of relationship that you must have been able to develop with him. How did you do that? Could you tell us a little bit, bringing this up to the Amber Heard case, could you tell us a little bit about your professional relationship with him and the types of matters that you had worked with him on?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the privilege of working on all his litigation, and there's been a number of litigation matters that we've handled for him. He sued his former business managers. That was the case that I was first staffed on. He then decided to initiate litigation against his former entertainment lawyer. And I've handled a small wage and hour dispute with two former bodyguards of his, misclassification case, and a number of other, what I would call general advice and counsel type of matters that have popped up throughout the years. And I think the reason that we established such a close relationship is because, first of all, I got to know all aspects of his life, right? So everything from his loan out companies to what's important to him in terms of his legacy, his children, his family. And we became friends. And I think that there's nothing wrong with caring for your clients and becoming friends with them, right? So that you have their best interest at heart. My advice would come from that place, right? Which is, I know these things are important to you, like your family, your name, your reputation. How do we accomplish those goals? Keeping in mind what your main objective is, to preserve mm-hmm. your legacy for your children, to mm-hmm. clear your name of really horrific allegations that had been right. made 6 years prior by his ex-wife. And so, you know, even though I didn't necessarily think that initiating a lawsuit against his ex-wife was in his best interest, I understood his reasons for wanting to do so. And after obviously advising him about the risks of initiating a defamation action, being a public figure and considering his ex-wife was also a public figure and, you know, the high standard that we would have to meet to prevail, it made complete sense to me. You know, he said, Camille, have you ever been accused of something you didn't do? And I thought about that for a minute and I said, no, Johnny, I don't think I have. And then he said, right, talk to me after you have been.
A couple of questions. Johnny Depp is a client of the firm that you work at, and you're an associate. And so presumably there was a partner who had the relationship with him. And I'm just reading between the lines here. It sounds like you and he connected, and he got to the point where he trusted you, and he was looking to you to be his legal advisor generally, on potential disputes, at least. I'm sure he has deal counsel. Was that at all awkward, that transition from a partner who had the relationship to you?
No, it wasn't awkward. And that's, I mean, I think that the partner, right, who is wonderful and someone I greatly admire and is a mentor of mine, Ben Chu. The relationship was encouraged by Ben, right? And I think Ben and Johnny have their own relationship, and Johnny definitely goes to Ben for advice, and we worked seamlessly together, Ben and I did. Okay. I think that, you know, to some extent, Johnny really appreciated the advice that I gave because I'm a woman. And I think that he understood and appreciated that sometimes a woman's perspective is going to be different than a man's perspective. And I think for him to make decisions, he wanted to get both of our perspectives. So I definitely developed a very close relationship with Johnny, but that's not in any way to take away from the relationship he has and still has with Ben, my partner.
You know, Hollywood celebrities and music artists, singers have a reputation sometimes as clients being difficult, temperamental, demanding, you know, hard to deal with in terms of trying to get them to focus on what are the issues, the real issues as you see them in their matter, as opposed to things that are tangential or other kinds of emotional things going on in their life. There's a reputation of that.
Sure.
And, you know, to be candid with you, I've seen some of that personally, but I gather Johnny's not like that. I mean, Johnny, he has the ability to focus on the merits of the legal issues and understands them. And in that respect, he's a good and easy client to work with. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. He's a very good client to work with, right? I throughout the litigation that we've handled for him, and it's been extensive, he said it's been a crash course in legal studies. And I think you saw a little bit of that humor perhaps displayed when he was being cross-examined in the Amber Heard matter, when he responded to some questions with, "Oh, is that hearsay?" Or he's a quick study. Right. And
actors can be very, very good on the witness stand.
Yes, of course.
They can be scary good.
He was fantastic, I thought, on the witness stand, but he was.
But both parties were actors in this case, so.
They were. But knowing Johnny as well as I do, what I would say is he was himself, mm-hmm. unapologetically himself, as soft-spoken and as thoughtful as he came off on the witness stand. That is the real Johnny Depp.
All right, well, let's talk about the case and the trial and your work in the courtroom now. I read somewhere that the trial was watched by something like 330 million people, which is an astonishing number to me. But for the benefit of the small number of people in this world, who may be listening to the podcast, who don't know anything about the case or its background, can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch about what the background was and what the claims were in the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Johnny initiated a lawsuit against his ex-wife for an op-ed that she wrote and that was published in the Washington Post in December of 2018. In that op-ed, there were three statements that Johnny alleged were defamatory because they were false. The most prominent one being that she became a public figure representing domestic abuse 2 years prior. So that would have taken us back to 2016, which for people that aren't aware, Amber Heard walked into court here in Los Angeles, California, and obtained an ex parte restraining order against her husband, who was Johnny Depp, and filed for divorce shortly thereafter, alleging that he had been abusive, physically abusive to her throughout their relationship.
And there had been a prior case, I may have the sequence wrong, but there had been a prior case in the United Kingdom?
That's right. There was a prior action that Johnny initiated against NGN, which publishes The Sun. It's a Murdoch-owned publication, tabloid publication in the UK, and against the author of an article, Dan Wooten, who published an article calling Johnny a wife beater. Mr. Depp initiated that lawsuit in the UK, a libel proceeding in the UK, and that went to trial prior to the Virginia action against Amber Heard going to trial just this summer.
He didn't do so well in the UK action, did he? Or
no, it was not the result that we were all hoping he would obtain. It was a very different proceeding, though. I mean, taking into account that Amber Heard, his ex-wife, was not a party, therefore she didn't have disclosure, the same disclosure obligations that a party would have and that she did have in this matter. And that's really important because I think a lot has been made of the fact that certain evidence was admitted in the UK libel action, but not in the US action. It's important for people to realize that when you're not a party to a lawsuit, you don't have to produce evidence in that proceeding. And so considering the fact that Amber, procedurally speaking, was not a party, she got to pick and choose the best evidence to give to the Sun that was then presented in the libel action in the UK.
I guess there was no way to serve her with a third party subpoena and get evidence from her in that UK proceeding. You'd have to go through a Hague Convention or something.
There were proceedings, and I obviously I'm not a UK solicitor, and I wasn't advising Johnny on those procedural matters, but she did give evidence in the UK.
She took the stand?
She did. She took the stand. Mm-hmm. They call it in the UK. I'm learning. Mm-hmm. They've called it. She gave evidence. So she
exactly.
She did. Yeah. She gave evidence both in written form. So instead of depositions in the UK, the witnesses provide what they call statements, written statements. So she provided a number of statements, and then she was cross-examined on the stand in the UK libel trial. And but you know, just as by way of an example, there is no hearsay law, as far as I understand, a hearsay objection in the UK. That's just not something that they have in their laws. And because of that, I think some what we consider unreliable evidence that should not be admitted was admitted in the UK libel action that was properly excluded in the US proceeding.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, I've attended trials in the UK, and they do, you know, argumentative questions. I mean, it seems like anything goes. You think of English barristers being these, you know, really precise, excellent questioners. You know, I think from a US trial lawyer's perspective, it seems to me like they get away with murder in the courtroom.
I agree, John. It was an amazing spectacle to behold, I'll tell you.
There is a process, 28 U.S.C. 1782, where you can apply to a federal court in the United States to invoke U.S. discovery procedures, U.S.-style depositions, document production, subpoenas, and the like, to get information and discovery in aid of a foreign proceeding. Do you know whether that procedure was used or considered, if you can say without violating attorney-client privilege?
I know it was used by the Sun against other witnesses here in the U.S., like the Los Angeles Police Department. So two police officers that responded to a 911 call in May of 2016 did testify in the U.K. proceeding. I don't know, and probably am not at liberty to discuss whether that was also contemplated for Ms. Heard specifically in the UK libel case.
I mean, generally what we think of the UK as being a more hospitable forum for defamation cases. I mean, I think the thought is, you know, generally reputation maybe matters more in UK culture than in UK culture. And it's one of the few civil areas where you still have jury trials in the UK. I mean, we inherited the jury trial via the Seventh Amendment in our country, but in the UK, they've all but abandoned it, as I understand it, except for criminal proceedings and, kind of weirdly to me, defamation proceedings. So was this a jury trial in London?
It was not. It was
really?
It was not a jury trial. And again, I don't know the reasons for that. And I'm not at liberty probably to discuss them, but it was not a jury trial. It was decided by a single judge who quickly retired after the decision was issued. And I just think he got it wrong. I mean, right. Reading his really long opinion was disheartening and frustrating, because any evidence that we had contrary to allegations of abuse were quickly dismissed. Mm. I mean, some of it he didn't even take into consideration in his decision. Mm. So if there was contradictory evidence, he would either quickly dismiss it or sometimes not even address it. So I think for the lawyers, we found the decision unfair and wrong. It's right. Plainly wrong.
This makes it even more remarkable that Mr. Depp would bring the defamation action that he brought against his ex-wife in Virginia. He's had this case, in the defamation case in the UK, similar or related allegations. He's a public figure, so he knows, he's going to have to prove actual malice. Truth is a defense. I'm sure you told him that. If you're a plaintiff and you bring a defamation action, I always tell clients, you open your life to yes. disclosure, because there's going to be wide scope for discovery on the grounds that, well, somehow it relates to truth as a defense. So this was a really, I mean, you have to say courageous for him to bring the courageous. We can say courageous now. If it hadn't gone well, people might have said it was crazy for him to do this.
I would say it was both, right? I think there's a bit of genius in being so open and wanting for transparency and truth. What I will say about Johnny is, he had really nothing else to lose. And I think for him, when you've been accused of something so horrific and your career has been damaged to the extent that his has been by these allegations, especially in this day.
Right. I'm sure he was, obviously in this day and age, post Me Too, I mean, this would threaten he probably couldn't get work, I'm guessing.
He had been canceled. I mean, there is no other way to say this. But besides the career, which obviously is incredibly important to him because he's an artist, I think it's easy to say, okay, fine, it's his career, but and he makes a lot of money. But I think we forget that he's an artist. Our careers are incredibly personal and important to us. They make up who we are as individuals. So yes, again, we were talking about a big life. We were talking about a lot of money, but it was a man's life, right? It's what made him him. And mm-hmm. and then there's the reputational harm. I mean, the fact that his children had to read or hear that he had hurt a woman, physically yeah. had abused a woman. Right. That's an allegation that you really can't get over.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the op-ed piece that she wrote that mm-hmm. he sued on, it doesn't even reference his name. Doesn't reference him by name, does it? Or correct
it
me
not.
If I'm wrong.
No. You're absolutely correct. It does not, but she didn't have to.
Right.
Everyone knew when reading that op-ed that the only person she could be possibly speaking about, when she timestamped it and said 2 years ago, I became a public figure representing domestic abuse, the only person she could be talking about was her ex-husband, Johnny right. Depp.
So he sues and she responds with a counterclaim.
She does, years later.
And what is the substance of the counterclaim?
Essentially, she moved on a number of claims, most of which were dismissed. So her counterclaim ended up being three statements made by a third party. And, I think the jury was really thoughtful in their deliberations when they came back and returned a verdict on the three statements that Johnny had moved on in the op-ed, essentially where Ms. Heard was alleging that she was a victim of domestic violence. And then the one statement that the jury found for Amber was based on a third party statement. It happens to be one of Mr. Depp's lawyers who made the statement it was buried in a Daily Mail article And it was in response to statements released by Amber's attorneys, where he very specifically and factually describes his opinions. We say it's his opinions of what took place the last night that Johnny and Amber were together in May of 2016 on a very factual basis. So the jury found that that probably didn't happen the way that this third party described, but they did not find that the other two statements that she had moved on describing her abuse allegations as a hoax were defamatory. So I think it was a really thoughtful decision.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the trial some. And look, I know there's an appeal pending, and so there's limits on what you can talk about. So by all means, just let me know if you're not comfortable for any reason in answering any of the questions that I ask. Going into the trial, what did you see as the biggest challenges that you faced?
Her biggest challenge was Amber Heard. I mean, if Amber was able to be persuasive and convince this jury and credible, right? Persuasive and credible that she had been physically abused, we would lose. Because as you said, really the only defense to defamation is truth. And so understanding that she's incredibly intelligent, she's beautiful, and she was going to be captivating on the stand, we saw as the biggest challenge.
How had she done in her deposition?
She did, I would say, better in her deposition than she did on the stand. I think she had moments in her deposition where she came off more credible. But taking into account that the deposition format, and I know you know this, is very different than a cross-examination. The point of a deposition is to elicit a lot of evidence and testimony from the witness. So we wanted her to talk in her deposition. We wanted to hear everything, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Right.
We needed her testimony on that.
I always say there are two purposes to a deposition. First, you want to hear what their account is. What is that? What are they going to claim happened here? And what evidence do they have to support it? And then you try to fish for admissions that you can then use at trial. So yes, it's a totally different exercise than on the witness stand.
Than on the witness stand, exactly.
How long was her deposition?
It was 3 days, 8 hours each day. Court ordered. She was ordered to appear in person in our offices in Irvine. Mm-hmm.
And how about Mr. Depp's? How long was his deposition?
He was ordered to sit for 3 days in Virginia as well. And interestingly, Ms. Heard's attorneys decided to depose him a year and a half prior to her deposition. And I never quite understood the timing of his deposition, but nevertheless, that's when they decided to take it. And, you know, that's when they did it. They did go back and ask for more time, which we agreed to give them by Zoom another, I think, half day.
Right. I mean, a lot of time, I think a lot of lawyers, and I usually think it's good to get that first deposition as early as possible to lock in, you know, the plaintiff, especially a plaintiff's account. Because as time goes by and more evidence comes out, that could shape their testimony and opportunities you might create for them to say things that you can then impeach them on based on subsequently produced evidence. You might lose that if the deposition's taken after the further along when the evidence is more on the table. But look, did you do any mock juries? If you
we
can
did
say.
Not. We did not. Do, right. We did not.
So did you have a sense of what types of jurors you were looking for? And if so, I mean, what types of jurors were you looking for? And how did you arrive at those conclusions as to what types of jurors you thought would be good for you?
We did work with a jury consultant and, you know, but that was very close to trial. I mean, weeks before trial started, and her main objective was to help us select the jury and organize the process. For us, based on the panel of, I think it was 150 jurors, potential jurors we were going to receive a few days prior to voir dire. But I had my own idea of the ideal juror, but that was not shared by our consultant. And then, you know, when we got our panel, just based on the group that we were, the cards we were dealt, right? I mean, we ended up with a jury that didn't look like anyone would have imagined. They
How
were
so?
They were mostly young men on the jury. And there were two women.
So what was the disagreement between you and the consultant about what type of jury you thought you wanted?
I thought I wanted, well, I did want women on the jury. And my thinking was, I think women are really adept at reading other women. Mm-hmm. And they have a good barometer for if someone's telling the truth or not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's been my experience, is that women are harder on women than men are, especially on sensitive issues like this. Women don't cut other women a lot of slack.
Yeah, I don't know that it's slack, but I just think that they tend to be in tune with their gut, right? Mm-hmm. Better than men. I think men can be really logical, but also swayed by emotions, right? So if you have an attractive defendant, which we did have, that potentially was going to be on the stand crying, my concern was if we had a predominantly male jury, we would have men in the jury just thinking, oh gosh, please make it stop. You know, this is very uncomfortable. Give her whatever she wants, and would not be able to listen to the evidence. And I thought women could be a bit more in tune with what their gut was telling them was actually happening.
But based on the veneer and the draw that you got, you didn't get the kind of jury you thought you wanted to have.
No, but I got more of a jury that my consultant thought that we should right. have. Uh-huh. She thought we needed men on the jury and you know, really kind of logical engineers. You know, the lawyers. That's not necessarily what we got, but we did get a predominantly male jury.
How long was the trial?
It was 6 weeks of testimony.
Okay. And it seems like there was coverage every day in like the New York Times. I mean, some would say there are arguably, let's say, more important trials going on from a public policy standpoint that didn't get anywhere near the coverage that your trial got. What did you see as were the key points in the trial, the key inflection points that looking back on it, that you thought, you know, these were the points where we were really scoring points and this is where we won the case?
You know, I think there were a few. I think that Johnny's testimony was a key point for us. It was the first time that the world, really the jury, right? In this case, the jury got to hear from him in his own words, in exactly the pace that he speaks at. And it was such an emotional moment for all of us that knew him, because to give this person the freedom and the venue to finally say, I didn't do this, and let me explain my experience in this relationship and why I'm bringing this lawsuit, was so incredibly important for us. Irrespective of what the verdict was going to be, we needed to give him the opportunity to speak and speak freely. And just to give him that gift was something that we had worked incredibly hard at. So I think when he finally did his direct examination and then was cross-examined, and I think he did a phenomenal job in cross-examination, we were just so relieved and thought to ourselves, again, irrespective of what happens, we are so grateful that we were able to give him this opportunity. So I think that was a high point for us. And then obviously the cross-examination of Amber, I thought was key.
Right.
You know, trials come down to, I think, the two people, right? At the end of the day, it's what he was going to say and what she was going to say. And it's a popularity contest in a lot of ways, right? Who does the jury like more? Who does the jury think is more credible? So I think we were really effective at making her come off not credible.
Right. Well, I want to talk about that, but first let me ask, was Johnny called as your first witness?
He was not. He was called in the second week, and he was called after we introduced the jury to Johnny Depp and who the real Johnny Depp was. Mm-hmm. That was important for us. So we introduced the jury to his sister, who was able to give a background about who the little boy was before he became Johnny Depp and who the man is now from a family's perspective. And we introduced the jury to some people that have worked for Johnny for a number of years. What's interesting about Johnny is he has a group of people that have been with him for years. I mean, minimum 20 years, most of them. He doesn't have, I mean, we're talking everything from assistants to bodyguards to his, you know, house staff. They have been with the man for 20, sometimes 30 years. They have seen his children be born, grow up. This is very much a family of people. And it was important for us that the jury understood that and saw who he was from their perspective.
That's a very interesting decision, because you were able to introduce the client, humanize the client. They would have essentially no cross-examination on those witnesses, I assume.
It was hard for them, I think. It was really difficult, other than to kind of repeat the same theme, which was, oh, well, Johnny supports you. He pays for your life, right? You work for Johnny Depp, so, oh, you're his sister. Of course you're not going to be honest. But, you know, when the jury hears the same story over and over and over again, these are people that have options. They don't have to work for Johnny Depp. If he's a terrible boss, they can go and work for someone else, right? I mean, they stay because they respect the man, they like the man, and they want to continue working for him. Mm-hmm. These weren't people that, I mean, take his bodyguards, for example. They're former LA sheriff's officers. They're former LAPD officers. They've worked for other, you know, high profile clientele in the past. They don't have to be there. If the man was abusing his wife in their presence, or they knew that it was going on, you really think all these people were going to stand around and say nothing because they were working for Johnny Depp? I mean, it was implausible.
Right. And you say he did well on cross-examination. I assume he gave you time. He made himself available. There was time to prepare him.
Yes.
We defended Elon Musk here in Los Angeles in a defamation case. So what I'm about to say is all public information. Or he was sued by that British diver relating to the incident regarding the boys that were lost in the cave in Thailand. And Elon tweeted that there was a whole back and forth about this. But he tweeted that the guy was a pedo guy. And so the Brit brought a defamation case against Elon Musk in federal court in Los Angeles. And Mr. Musk, you know, is a very busy man. I mean, SpaceX, Tesla, and all the other things he has going on. And he's really a visionary. And spending time with lawyers is not at the top of Mr. Musk's idea of time well spent, is my impression. And he was called as the first witness by the plaintiff in this defamation case. And it's called on cross-examination. He's the first witness. And like the first question to him is something like, you're a really important man and people really care about what you say. They tend to believe what you say. And there was a beat. And Elon said, You know, actually, I'm not sure that's true, because I've been talking about climate change and the need for the world to get behind, put fossil fuels behind us. I've been talking about that for years and years, and I'm not sure people are listening or reacting fast enough. So, Council, I'm not sure the people listen to what I have to say at all. Now, I wish I could say that our lawyers had planted that.
I was going to say, okay, that. John, so no, are you going to tell me that you told him, you gave him that answer?
No, first off, I was not the trial lawyer, but sometimes you have a witness who's just natural and brilliant at it. And that's the sort of thing that you couldn't have thought up. You couldn't have anticipated the question. You couldn't have planted the answer. It just happened and it was authentic. Were there moments like that when Mr. Depp was cross-examined?
Absolutely. There were, I think, a number of moments where he was cross-examined. He was able to lighten the mood with some humor, right? I think he was able to take his time. And I think there's nothing more disruptive for an attorney in cross-examination than a witness that will not engage with you at your pace and speed. There's nothing more frustrating. And he did that brilliantly, in my opinion. He took the advice of take a beat, take five beats, listen to the question, and then respond. And, you know, it part of it is he actually suffers from a bit of a stutter. Again, something people don't really know about him. And so that's just the way he speaks. But it really, I think, was effective for him to be able to think about his answers and control the speed of the examination. And then there were some really just, Johnny's really well-spoken. He's eloquent. He's incredibly intelligent. And I think there were just some responses to some questions where, you know, he was asked, what did you lose? And he said, nothing short of everything. And he's almost poetic in the way he speaks and the way he writes. And it was so poignant, you know, that moment. You could hear a pin drop when he spoke. I felt like the jury, the lawyers, I mean, I've heard Johnny, I've spoken with Johnny countless times, right? But we were waiting for the next word to come out of his mouth. I felt like everyone was so captivated by his testimony, both in direct and in cross. And I think he did a brilliant job of explaining and showing the jury that he was incapable of doing the things that she accused him of doing.
Okay, now contrast Amber Heard. I mean, she's an actress too. And you said very intelligent, very beautiful.
She is.
How did she come across on the stand? Did you cross her?
I did. Assume,
yeah. So how did she come across?
I don't think she came off credible or likable. And I think there's a number of reasons why that is. But everything from she constantly responded to questions during cross-examination by looking at the jury. It appeared manufactured.
Yeah, I always think that's a bad idea. You know, that some lawyers tell, and you know, look at me for the question. Then when you answer, turn and look at the jury. I think the jury thinks they're being pandered to.
I think it's a strange experience. I've never served as a juror. And we did have a juror come out and speak to the media. He has remained anonymous, but he said that it was bizarre for them to sit there and to have Amber Heard speaking to them, and for them not to be able to respond. I mean, there were some jurors, one in particular that was closest to the witness stand, that during her cross-examination literally turned his body away from her. So many of them just
that's a good sign. That's a good sign.
It was a good sign for us, but it was amazing to me that Amber, her attorneys, really couldn't course correct. They couldn't pivot, irrespective of what was happening in the trial, right? As the trial was going on and the cross-examination was going on, they really didn't seem to be able to adjust and change their strategy or approach. So I think that was something that was problematic for her. I also think she was incapable of taking accountability for anything. Mm. And that was such a sharp contrast to the way Johnny testified. He immediately from the start took accountability for, as an example, his drug and alcohol sobriety, issues with sobriety throughout his life. He explained it and he apologized for the language he had used that was not nice and vulgar and crude. And he apologized for it, but he also explained it, right? And I just feel like Ms. Heard was really incapable of taking accountability for anything. And she really dug in on some things that if I were her lawyer, I would have advised her to answer differently.
Give it up, you know, don't fight on everything. Give up what you should give up. So how much of your cross was, you know, tied to the deposition where you really had controls, either deposition answers or documents? And how much of it was you out there kind of untethered to some control where you just thought your instincts told you, I think I can get this?
I think it was a combination, but what was really important to me was to tie my questions to something she had said previously. And because this case had really kind of been going on for a number of years, 6 years, if you go back to the first time she went to court, filed for an ex parte TRO, I had a lot, you know, under oath. We had the libel trial in the UK where she had submitted, I think it's a number like 7 witness statements. And then her testimony for 3.5 days in the box, they call it, right, in the UK, when she gave testimony in trial. I had statements made by spokespeople for Amber. I had her own statements that she had given in interviews. I had her on tape. I think the tapes were crucial to the cross-examination. I think for us, I wanted the jury to see who the real Amber Heard was. And to me, the real Amber Heard was so clearly in those audio recordings. So Johnny and Amber would record each other having mm-hmm. discussions about, like, this is during their relationship. So right. They would record each other.
Surreptitiously.
And, yeah.
But they were in a jurisdiction where you didn't need bilateral consent?
No. So not surreptitiously. No, it wasn't in secret. They would inform one another that they were recording each other. I think they were advised to do so by a therapist to kind of, you know, be able to say, well, we talked about this and this is the conclusion we came to. Of course, that's not what these tapes ended up being, right? A lot right. of them were just them having arguments on right. these tapes, but they were both unfiltered. I don't mm-hmm. think either of them thought these tapes were ever going to be heard right. around the world. And what we learned.
Lots of material there, I'm guessing.
There was
lots
so
of
much material. And what was so striking to us was that's where we saw the real Amber Heard. The Amber Heard that our client had described, and not just our client, multiple witnesses, every witness that we had ever interviewed, deposed, etc., had described, this is the real person. And I just thought to myself, I need to play those recordings over and over and over again and quote her so that the jury sees and hears who the real person is, not the one that's going to likely get on the stand and cry and tell this tale of woe. No, the real Amber Heard in this relationship, while discussing incidents, while fighting with Johnny Depp, the real person.
And we don't often get that kind of evidence to help us plan a cross-examination.
No, I need to write a thank you note to whatever therapist recommended that.
Sometimes there's a problem with having too much information. I tried one of these 3M earplugs cases, one of the bellwether trials, and there had been 12 or 13 of them before with a lot of the same witnesses. And I had witnesses I was going to cross-examination, you know, depositions and previous trial testimony, all a little bit different. And sometimes you can have too much material. It'd drive you crazy.
So true. And that was definitely the case in this matter as well. So it was about, you know, I said to Johnny, we're not going to right every wrong in your relationship. Right. We just need to pick out the big lies. We need to pick out the really big lies that can show the jury that you're incapable of committing physical abuse. You did not commit physical abuse, and she's not being truthful.
So you started this trial as an associate in your law firm. And I understand that during the trial, you were promoted to partner.
It wasn't during the trial. It was shortly after the verdict.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. I was promoted to partner.
Right. It's obvious testament to your fantastic work that you did in the courtroom. Just to conclude on the trial here, any other comments, things you learned or observations about the trial and the trial practice that you'd wish to share, things that stand out from the whole experience?
It was a lot of fun. You know, this was a really fun case to try for a number of reasons. It had to do with the team. We had a young, bright group of people that tried this case, the majority of which were associates. And I count myself in that group because I was an associate at the time. And I still look in the mirror and see an associate. But it was so much fun to be able to do this case with my colleagues that were around my age range and to think about these issues from our young, maybe less experienced eyes, right? Of how to present this case in this day and age to a jury. And I can't underscore enough the preparation, right? And the over-preparation that's required for trial. And I know you and I have spoken about this offline, but trial work, being a lawyer really just requires an immense amount of preparation.
It's hard work.
And hard work.
Did you sleep well during the trial?
I slept well, the little that I slept.
That's a good answer. You're a positive person.
Yeah.
So what are you on to now?
I have some interesting potential matters that have come across my desk at this point. And it's just about choosing the right case, or the right, cases. Obviously, there is now a brand, right, associated with my legal work, and I take that really seriously because there's responsibility, and I want to be able to do good. I want to be able to help people that need help, especially navigating our legal system and making it more accessible. And I think that to the extent that I can help future clients to against terrible allegations that are untrue or assist them out of a complex problem, it's really my honor to do so. I'm a naturally born advocate, and it's what I love to do, is to help people that don't have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great thought to close on. Camille, thank you so much for joining us. This has been such an interesting conversation. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Law Disrupted with me, John Quinn. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, lawdisrupted.fm. If you enjoyed the show, please share a link on social media and follow at JBQ Law or at Quinn Emanuel. Thank you for tuning in.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by Podcast Partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.